As counsel for appellant Audrey Klimowitz, may it please the court. The issues in this case, which is a denial of habeas corpus relief, are the Crawford errors and the Bruton errors that violated my client's right to confrontation. What happened was that the Illinois jury was told by the Illinois prosecutor after the client, my client and the boyfriend were arrested, that the boyfriend had told the whole story and the true story to the police, which in no uncertain terms implicated my client in the crimes to the police and to the jury. All of this was testimonial, and it was error for the district court to conclude that it was not. It was testimonial because it was referring to the classic police statements that the framers meant to exclude. The declarant was a suspected accomplice. His statements were unsworn. They were made during interrogation, made to the police and the prosecutors. They were solemnly made. They were solemnly received. They were under.
But what are you going to do with footnote 9 of Crawford that says, in effect, if the statement isn't being offered to establish the truth of the matter, it's not testimonial. And here the argument is that his underlying statement never comes in. Just the fact that he's told the whole story has come in, or he's told the truth. And that's being offered, according to the state, to show why it was she chose to confess when she did. She sort of, the jig's up.
Well, it was being offered for the truth of the matter asserted, for one
thing. How could it be?
Is this the statement of the boyfriend?
It's the statement of the boyfriend.
And he says, in the presence of the defendant, I've told him the whole truth?
That's correct. That's correct.
That's the entirety of what you're kicking about?
Well, what happens is that then...
No, I know, but is that the entirety?
Those references come in to in front of the jury.
Was that the statement you're objecting to?
That's correct, Your Honor. That's correct. And the statement is very, very powerful. And the
only
way...
But he never says the whole truth is that both of us killed her, or that you did, or that I did, or that, you know, some third party did. I mean, he looks her in the eye and says, I told the whole truth.
Well, what the district court, too, found that the inference and the insinuation were inescapable. Even according to the district court, it was as simple as inferring the way he said it. The jury would put two and two together. And basically, it's impossible for the jury, in this case, the way it came in and the whole purpose of it, that the jury would not have concluded that he implicated her. Is back and forth, the police were going, the prosecutor was going from room to room in the interrogation room, confronting over and over again the jury, hearing all along that these statements were being confronted to Hector. And if they hadn't been true, then the prosecutor would not have ever been making these references and bringing into evidence. And Crawford supports this position because Crawford obliterates this distinction between saying something indirect, insinuating versus a blatant kind of statement, which is what we had in the Bruton line of cases.
Well, so, I mean, what the district court says, I knew I was going to find this, it's over on page 14 of its opinion. What he says is, in short, the fact that a jury might have put two and two together after hearing the references to Mercado and then hearing Klimowitz's confession, in which she admitted to killing her mother, does not give rise to a Bruton-type confrontation clause problem. So the judge doesn't quite say, the minute you hear that Mercado says, tell the whole truth, you jump to the conclusion that Mercado is essentially winking at her and saying, yes, we both did it.
Well, Your Honor, I think he does, because he also says, to be sure. And I think the only reason he uses the word might is he's talking about what, to him, the impediment is the legal issue, that it's indirect, not that it wasn't conveyed to the jury. And I don't think it's the moment. It's the 27 hours that the jury is hearing. They're hearing it over and over and over and over again. So maybe the first time they hear it, it's a little on the oblique side. But over and over and over again, that there would be no reason to be confronting the jury unless he was implicating
but
her.
But there's every reason, because she's pushing the argument that her confession was coerced and that she was just exhausted and tired, and so I'll write anything down on the paper that you want me to. And so the state's entitled to come in and say, maybe this was a really long period of time and you were exhausted and hungry and all the rest of it, but the fact is you chose freely to confess as soon as you realized that the implicit cooperation between you and Mercado was over.
Your Honor, nothing that Audrey testified to did anything to open the door to that. Her testimony was not that she was coerced in any manner over and above what is inherent in the coercive atmosphere in the police station, if you will. She's saying she was tired, overnight, confinement. Those are things that are implicit in the coercive atmosphere. In fact, she testified that she trusted the police and that she ended up confessing because she thought they believed her. So if every time...
But I don't understand that at all. I mean, she eventually confesses, and that's, you know, huge in the state's case.
That's correct.
Obviously, to prove her guilt. And so she's got to do something about the confession. She's got to cause the jury to think that the confession isn't the true story.
That's correct.
Right? And so she's saying, well, it was really just coerced from me. It wasn't real. And the state's then entitled to come back, and they say, well, no, actually, you were trying to avoid confessing, mm-hmm. but you realized there came a time that it wasn't worth it.
Well, this case is really very different. I think this can answer your question from the Street case, where the state comes back because she specifically says, and the analogy would be Hector would exonerate me, or she refers to his statements. She doesn't do any of that. She's saying the ordinary kind of thing that someone is sitting there. I think the defense attorney argues it's like if you don't read the fine print on your mortgage papers. That's what he's saying. And if the state or the government can always, if that always presents an issue, if the state can come in with these unsworn statements that can be not cross-examined, then we would always be opening the door to Bruton and Crawford violations, and that would really be intolerable. And I think
but what does it mean from a different point of view when Mercado says, mm-hmm. I've told them the whole truth? Mm-hmm. What does that mean? I mean, I don't know why you equate that to saying, I confess to the killing.
Because saying the whole and true story after the 27-hour buildup is, and then she tells the, quote, truth as well, is why would she be doing that if he had said something that wasn't implicating her or something that was fantastical? And the whole context of it is inescapable. There is really no other interpretation but that it was relevant and that he was implicating her. I will reserve the rest.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm Assistant Attorney General Eric Levin on behalf of the respondent appellee, Warden Caroline Trancoso. At the outset, I think it's important to clarify, and I think this was sort of clarified a little bit in my opposing counsel's argument in response to the question from Judge Bauer, it's important to clarify what was presented to the jury and what wasn't, and relatedly, what arguments the state made based on what was presented and what arguments they didn't make. And I think the district court got it right in its opinion, and I should note also the trial transcript was submitted to the district court and it is part of the record on appeal. And the trial transcript makes clear that the substance of Mercado's statements were never presented to the jury. The jury never heard any statements from Mercado implicating the petitioner, and the state never argued to the jury that Mercado had implicated the petitioner. Petitioner does cite a couple times in her reply brief to M83 and M84 in the record, where she says that the state in its rebuttal closing argument argued that Mercado had admitted to ridding the body. I think a proper reading of that portion of the record shows that in the closing argument, the state at that point was going through the evolution of the petitioner's statements, where at one point she said Mercado didn't dispose of the body, then Mercado did dispose of the body, and then she, after being confronted with Mercado, she then again admitted that Mercado disposed of the body. So I think a proper reading of that shows that the state was never arguing in that at that part or in any other portion of the transcript that Mercado implicated petitioner. All that was admitted here was, and the only out-of-court statement of Mercado's that was admitted was his statement that was made to the petitioner, none of his statements that were made to the police. And those statements were introduced for a legitimate, non-hearsay purpose of showing the circumstances that led up to the petitioner's confession. Petitioner made this an issue as early as her opening statement, where in the opening statement, petitioner's trial counsel argued, you know, petitioner five or six or seven times was giving exculpatory statements. The only reason she then gave an inculpatory statement, according to petitioner's trial counsel, was because she just was saying whatever it is she thought the police wanted to hear so they would stop interrogating her. Just as the court said in Street, that if the state were not then allowed to explain these circumstances, it would essentially hamstring the state's case. You know, the state has a very logical reason to give to the jury for why the petitioner did suddenly change course and confess. And as the state argued in closing, it was because upon being confronted with Mercado and hearing Mercado say, "I told them the truth," she then essentially changed course. And so it's a logical explanation to rebut her claims of coercion and her claims that her statement was simply false. Under Tennessee versus Street, which was explicitly reaffirmed in Crawford, introducing out-of-court statements for non-hearsay purposes raises no confrontation clause problems. This court's recognized that post-Crawford in Tolliver, Nettles, James. We cite the Second Circuit's case of Logan, which also recognized that. Just briefly, if I can address a few of petitioner's arguments. Petitioner argues that, well, this was very powerful evidence. And that's true. This was strong evidence for the state. But I think the Second Circuit in Logan explains persuasively why, simply because the evidence ultimately was strong evidence against petitioner, does not equate it with a confrontation clause violation.
I guess the only there's a common sense level here, and actually it's a level that also comes up if you happen to be a game theory fan and you like thinking about prisoners' dilemmas. When the prisoners can't be cooperating with each other, you get one outcome, and all of a sudden when they discover that cooperation has happened at one place, they will shift their behavior. And so my guess is, as time went on, the jury understood this reference to the whole truth as being, you did it. I mean, if the whole truth really was, you know, that some person came in from Indiana and did this and then left again, telling the whole truth wouldn't be the sort of thing to pop a confession out of you. So I suspect the jury, probably at a pragmatic level, did hear this as exactly what petitioner argues.
Well, I think, though, first of all, the jury was instructed to consider only the evidence that's presented. So I think to indulge this assumption is, you know, sort of...
Well, what they're hearing is Mercado told the whole truth, and they have to decide, what does that mean?
But even still...
Of course, the vast response would be, thank God you did. We're home free.
Exactly. And I think that raises a good point, which is that what the jury is able to infer from the statement depends ultimately on how petitioner reacted to hearing it, which is exactly the non-hearsay purpose that the state was introducing it for. Otherwise, if we're going to – I don't think it's proper to assume that the jury would speculate on, well, what did Mercado say?
What did Mercado mean when he said what we all know he said?
Yeah. And for the state's purposes, whether or not Mercado had told the police anything is irrelevant. What's relevant is that petitioner heard Mercado say, I told them the truth, and that she then reacted –
Tell me, as a matter of law, do you think it's appropriate if somebody walked in, a detective walked in and said, your partner just told the whole truth, without that being an absolute barefaced lie? Is there anything wrong with that? And she says, oh, I'm cooked, and she confesses.
I'm not aware of any case law that would say there's anything wrong with that, and certainly it would
Several
not be a
confrontation. Several cases that say it's perfectly appropriate, as a matter of fact.
Exactly, and at the very least, it's not a confrontation clause problem, because the person making that statement, the detectives, they did testify and they were able to be cross-examined. in this case, on for the non-hearsay purpose for which these statements were introduced, there's really no need for petitioner to cross-examine Mercado. They can cross-examine the detectives who are the ones relaying the statement. If there are no further questions, I would ask the court to affirm the judgment of the district court, which held that the Illinois appellate court's decision rejecting petitioner's confrontation clause claim was not contrary to or an unreasonable application of clearly established federal law.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You have 2 minutes, counsel.
Thank you. First of all, as far as distinguishing between truth and falsity, there's a big difference between saying, as Street and some of the other cases say, and Logan, which was a false alibi. That's not coming in for the truth of the matter asserted. And that is proper, but that's not the situation we have here. There's no way that the prosecutor in this case wanted the jury to think that Mercado was lying. In fact, if that is what the message would have been to the jury, then the prosecutor would have argued in closing, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, don't concern yourself with truth or falsity. Mercado could be lying for all we care. But that's not what they did. That's not the way they argued in closing, because that was not their message.
But what they want, of course, is the jury to think that Klimowitz is telling the truth in her confession, because if she's telling the truth in her confession, the case is over.
That's correct, and that's
why. And so that's all they're arguing. You know, you come in, you get this statement, you know, your partner has sold you out, so tell the truth.
And that's correct, and that's where we're talking about the hearsay corroborative purpose of Hector's statement being true, because the only way the message is that the only way Audrey's statement is true is that Hector's statement is true. And that's where the truth
or
of the matter is.
Or that she believes that Hector has told the truth.
And that's correct. And so, and that would be, and the jury is thinking if she believes it, it has to be true. So, you know, we're splitting hairs there if we try to make a distinction between what she believes.
No, she believes that then her statement is true. It doesn't really matter whether he recited the phone book to them, you know.
Well, it does in this case, because the prosecutor argued in closing that's the coup de grace, which means death blow. So no one is just talking about what Audrey's thinking. They're talking about this being death blow and the gig being up. Tennessee versus Street is vastly distinguishable in this case on its facts and for constitutional purposes. Crawford, as you were saying, and as the state was mentioning, I believe the state mentioned Crawford. Crawford obliterates that distinction between indirect and direct, and I think that's important. In the footnote, there must be read harmoniously with Crawford, because Crawford obliterates those distinctions and talks about the core class of accomplice statements. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.